Welcome to this session, Optimizing Group Policy in VDI Environments. I appreciate you making it to the session. We are in almost the last room on the last day, right after lunch, so you're a brave bunch. I'm Darren Marilia. I'm a CTO and founder of a company called SDM Software and GPOGuy.com. How many of you have been to GPOGuy.com or hung around any of my sites? Great. I'm a group policy MVP from Microsoft, and generally all things group policy is what I usually talk about, but in the last couple of years I've had some fun with virtual desktop environments, and so thought it would be a great topic to combine since VDI is starting to become kind of hot in a busy space. At some point during my talk, I've got a couple of gizmos that Microsoft gave me to hand out, so I'll find like some. If somebody asks an awesome question, or if I ask some question and somebody knows the answer in an awesome way, I will pitch these. These are USB power sticks. So I guess you can use it as a 4-gig USB drive or charge your phone, which is kind of cool. All right, let's get started. So what's so special about virtual desktops? Actually, let me get a show of hands. How many of you are doing VDI projects in your environment? Great, lots of you. How many of you have already implemented and are looking at ways of optimizing it? Most of you. Cool. So what I'm going to talk about today and why I decided to combine these two topics is, you know, there's a lot that's different about VDI from physical desktops. And there's enough different that, you know, it takes some special consideration when you're designing your VDI environment. And group policy being the kind of the Windows configuration management technology that we have in the box is a great way of sort of being able to optimize your VDI instances. So what I'm going to talk about is some of the GPO design considerations for VDI, GPO settings that can impact VDI performance or VDI scalability. You know, with VDI, it's all about how many virtual machines can I get on my Hyper-V or ESX or whatever host environment you're working in. Use of loopback, which is a particular technology to group policy that can come in handy in VDI environments. Some image considerations, things to think about when you're creating VDI templates. And user state virtualization. So this is all about essentially roaming profiles and folder redirection. We'll talk a little bit more about that. So just for those of you who are not doing VDI and just for the purposes of context, what do I mean by VDI? I mean a desktop PC running in a VM on a hypervisor like Hyper-V, some kind of remote access device, thin client, laptop, phone, you know, iPad, whatever your remote access device is, using some kind of remote display protocol like RDP, RemoteFX, Citrix HDX, et cetera, and a connection broker. And the connection broker is kind of the mediator. You're coming in from your access client, you hit the connection broker. The connection broker tells you which desktops you're entitled to and then redirects your session there. So that's kind of the main parts and pieces of a typical VDI deployment, regardless of whether you're talking about Microsoft, Citrix, VMware, et cetera. So those are the pieces that kind of differentiate a VDI environment from a typical physical desktop environment or just RDPing to a desktop running somewhere. I'll make one note about questions. We'll try to leave the questions to the end, but if you have a burning question that you really want to get answered after I've said something, then feel free to either shout it out or better yet, go to the mic, and I'll try to answer it. So some of the design considerations. Why is VDI different? Well, all the desktops are running in the data center typically, or potentially up in a public cloud, and usually on shared or centralized storage, so NAS, SAN, direct attached storage, not so much, but usually SAN environments. Host resources, in other words, the things, the hardware that the Hyper-V host is running are shared across all those guests, just like in a server environment. That's different, right? When you have a physical desktop implementation, you have all these little islands out in your environment that are doing their own thing. If a disk drive fails on one desktop, physical desktop, it only impacts that one user. Not the case if there's failure in a VDI environment. And then if you're implementing non-persistent desktops, you have additional considerations around sort of on-the-fly desktops. So what are non-persistent desktops? typically, depending on your VDI implementation, you have this notion of either a persistent desktop, which means I'm essentially putting a virtual machine, a VDI instance, on my hypervisor that a particular user connects to, almost as if it was their physical machine. So it's managed in a one-to-one kind of relationship. The user owns that machine, if you will. It's all of their apps, all of their settings and stuff, and that's their experience in VDI. Non-persistent desktops, which are kind of the place that everyone wants to get to because it's the lowest cost model, is that you have a single image up there in your VDI land that's shared by multiple users. And when they log on, they get the virtual desktop. It's sort of built on the fly with their apps and their user data. And when they log off, it can optionally go away. In other words, it's no longer personalized for them. So that's kind of the nirvana for VDI, is you've got that physical desktop OS, or I'm sorry, the virtual desktop OS. You've got user data, and you've got applications that all come together dynamically to create that VDI experience, and then go away dynamically when the user's done. So that obviously has some ramifications for how you manage these systems. So as I said, why do you have to be concerned with VDI as opposed to physical? Much more sensitive to performance considerations. So bad behavior by one or a few virtual machines. You've got some machine that's running some antivirus scan that's hammering your disk in a shared disk environment, not a good thing. Disk I.O., IOPS, I.O. operations per second, is like the bottleneck that you have to be concerned about. Certainly memory as well, but disk I.O. is always the killer in VDI environments. User experience issues. So you've got this problem where the user has to have as good experience or better from their access client as they would in a physical desktop. No one's going to put up with a really crappy user experience just because it's VDI. And then you've got these kind of issues related to whatever remoting display protocol you're using and the network connectivity and the types of applications you're using. If you're trying to run a flash video across a 256K WAN link, it's probably not going to look very good. So there's lots of those kinds of considerations that we have to think about. These are all pieces of the puzzle that impact what you're ultimately trying to deliver is, you know, almost as good or better virtual desktop experience from what the user would get if they were on their own physical desktop. I can tell you today, and I'm sure many of you have discovered this, that it's not there's no one universal solution for this. There's no one product or one solution that builds a VDI environment that is absolutely perfect out of the gate, and it works with all applications. I saw a pretty cool demo a few weeks back from a vendor that I had been talking to that had built their own remoting protocol, and they were showing how they could display a Terminator video, the movie Terminator, on an iPad over 3G in almost real time. That was the coolest thing I had ever seen in VDI world. Most VDI implementations, and that wasn't even a VDI implementation per se, it was just some proprietary protocol that they had built. Most VDI implementations can't get there right now. Or if they can, you need really low latency, high bandwidth links to do it. So these are all considerations that you're going to have to go into when you're designing your VDI environment. And group policy can help with a lot of this in terms of tweaking and tuning that behavior. So let's talk a little bit about designing VDI implementations. So in a Windows world, most organizations are using Active Directory. Active Directory being the place where all authentication and authorization happens. It's also the place that we use to target group policy. So in a typical VDI environment, what I like to do is create a separate OU for those VDI systems. That allows me to target policy that is specific to those VDI systems in a really easy way. So you can manage the system separately. You know physically or logically and visually that they are separate types of systems, and it becomes easier to manage. If you decide to do loopback processing, which is something I'll talk about in a little bit, then it's infinitely easier to do loopback if you've got these machines separated out in their own OU. a lot like when you make, if you're running terminal services or ZenApp environments, it's the same kind of consideration. Using loopback in those environments is pretty common. Typically, you put them in their own OU and keep them separate and keep them managed separately as well. So let's talk a little bit more about disk. Disk is, as I mentioned, a big bottleneck. It can be a big bottleneck. It's something you really have to plan for. IOPS, when you go into your VDI implementation, you have to think about how your current physical environment is working today. Some desktop operations that are no big deal on physical desktops suddenly take on a whole new concern. Startup and shutdown of a machine. Imagine if you deployed some update to all your desktops that required them to reboot at roughly the same time, or you had some issue when you were requiring your users to reboot. In the physical world, no big deal. The disks are turning away on those physical machines, but in a VDI environment, you've got all those physical or those virtual machines sharing disk. So you can imagine all the IOPS that are happening during a restart, and if those are all happening at the same time, you've got a bad situation. You could get VMs falling over, hosts falling over, disk subsystems having problems, et cetera. So those kinds of activities you have to basically design for. If you're anticipating that kind of reboot storm, if you will, then you're going to have enough capacity for it in your disk, whatever implementation, SAN or otherwise. Antivirus scans, something that is another common thing on physical desktops, not a good thing in virtual desktop environments. Or if it is, you really want control over it. Other types of services that get installed by default on Windows 7, like search, defrag, etc. Again, those are things that make sense in a physical world that probably don't make sense in a virtual world. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then again, there's this sort of symbiotic relationship between memory and disk, right? If you've got enough memory available to your VM for the workload that the user's running, then no disk paging is going to happen, or very little. If you start to run into a situation where you've got lots of applications running, you haven't sized your VMs correctly, then suddenly you've not only got memory issues, but now you've got disk issues, because I can tell you that paging is a very IO-intensive operation. If I have to page to disk to swap in and out virtual memory, it's not a good thing for VDI. So again, memory pressures on VMs have a cascading effect on disk. You definitely need to pay attention to memory allocation when you're defining your virtual machines. You can use group policy to turn off unneeded services. So trying to get that memory footprint on your base machine down to very minimum level as possible, so that really as much of the memory as can be is devoted to the business applications that are running on those virtual machines. And if you're running Hyper-V as your desktop virtualization infrastructure, SP1 has this killer feature called dynamic memory. I went to a session given by one of the Hyper-V folks the other day. He said that they saw as much as a 40% increase in the density of virtual VDI instances on a Hyper-V server when this was enabled. This basically gives you the ability gives the hypervisor the ability to dynamically adjust the memory of guests based on their usage. And they had seen in their testing something like a 40% increase in the number of guests they could put on a typical hypervisor host. So that's a really cool feature that can help with a lot of this, in terms of both performance and the density, the magic density number that you can get with in a VDI environment. So I always recommend that before you go to VDI, you have a really good sense of the workload that your systems are running today, your physical systems are running. And what that means is really kind of sitting down with your users in a typical work scenario and profiling their usage, whether it's Perfmon or whatever tools that you have for monitoring desktop performance. Look at IOPS, look at memory usage, typical memory usage over time, how the CPU is functioning. If the CPU is really busy, if you have really CPU-intensive applications, that will help you in sizing you know, what's going on with the virtual environment, how you size your VMs. Video, another performance area related to the access device. So the applications that are on that virtual machine have to be displayed, whatever routing protocol you're using, back to the access device. So depending on what's going on and the network speed, that can be a real source of problem. Mostly it results in a bad experience for the user. I've seen situations where the screen becomes unreadable or unusable in high latency or low bandwidth situations. The network's really congested. There are other problems. So even though the VM itself is just poking along, doing just fine, what the user sees is not fine. And the challenge with that is that, you know, there's no good instrumentation out of the box to know exactly what the user is being displayed on their screen. You know, some of the remoting protocols do have the ability to trace them and create logs and be able to see when there are problems from the protocol's perspective, but nothing is going to help you with what the user actually sees on the screen, other than the user calling the help desk and saying, all I see is a bunch of streaks across my screen. So that's an area that you have to be sensitive about. Applications with a lot of graphical activity or multimedia, playing a Windows movie or a Flash movie, letting your users run that kind of an application in VDI may not be such a good idea if they're on high latency or low bandwidth links. So, you know, in the Microsoft world, we've got RDP, and now with Service Pack 1, we've got RemoteFX. RDP has been around forever. Version, I think, 5 is what it is now, is fairly robust and fairly able to handle a variety of situations. It's got its anomalies and it's got its limitations, but it's a pretty good protocol, remote display protocol. RemoteFX was designed and optimized for those high bandwidth types of applications like multimedia. It is not designed, and Microsoft will tell you this, for low-speed, high-latency links. So if you're rolling this out to WAN users or to users dialing in from Starbucks and expecting them to be able to see rich multimedia experience well, it's not going to happen. Citrix has their HDX protocol. It has its own set of characteristics, pretty good over those low-speed, high-latency links. But again, these are all going to be subject to the kinds of applications you're running and the bandwidth that's available to the user. And this is just a quick screenshot. In this screenshot, what I'm doing is I'm just looking at the search indexer, which is the search Microsoft search or Windows search process, and looking at its IOPS behavior on my physical desktop over time. And of course, I can do this. I can create a collector set in Perfmon. I pick a bunch of parameters, disk I/O, CPU, memory used, and just log it in the background for my users over time to collect kind of a good baseline. Then I can go back and look at it and see, okay, what are these users typically doing from a system resource perspective on a day-to-day basis? So let's talk a little bit more about, and this is more within the realm of group policy, what are some of the things that I can do to try to help optimize my VDI experience? Well, if I'm rolling out Windows 7, we now have defrag as a scheduled task. And it's going to run I don't even know how often it runs, but it's going to run every so often and essentially try to defrag your hard disk. Now, if I'm in a SAN environment, that doesn't really mean much to me because the SAN is typically has some kind of smart controller or it's doing its own optimization of the content much better than what Windows is going to do. And so do I really need each of my VMs hammering the disk to do defrag every couple hours or whatever it is? Probably not. Windows search. So this is the thing that indexes all the content or a vast majority of content on your local C drive, on your Windows drive. Do I need that? Sometimes I do. If my users are doing a lot of content searching across different content on their system, maybe they need this thing, but maybe not. Another area where disk can get hammered if indexing is happening, especially if there's a lot of activity going on the hard drive. Windows Update. Do you really need to run Windows Update on every VM Or are you patching a master image and pushing that out to your users on a periodic basis? Like if you're using non-persistent desktops, the typical model is you don't let the individual VMs patch each of their instances. You have a master image that you patch and periodically refresh all of those replicas or all of those whatever they happen to be, whatever the technology is, if it's Citrix or VMware or Microsoft. You essentially have a way of doing that from a central image. And then Windows Defender. Again, do you need Windows Defender doing its thing, doing scans every night on every machine? You know, there's some technology out now that can actually do some of the security functions at the hypervisor level instead of at the individual guest level. Now, this is where I think we all want to be over time, and the vendors are going to get there in terms of not managing the guest as it is a physical guest, but managing it as it is a virtual machine in a hypervisor. So why not run some of these functions at the hypervisor level and not tax every virtual machine? So these are, you know, functions that you would typically have running in a physical environment that probably don't make sense in a virtual environment. System restore. Again, this probably doesn't make sense at all for either persistent or non-persistent desktops in a virtual environment, and so why keep this data lying around? Why create system restore points, or let the user create system restore points if they have that ability? Let's just turn it off. Offline files. Offline files is designed for roaming users who are disconnected from the network, do not need to be in virtual VDI environments. And BitLocker, same thing, right? We don't need to encrypt the disk. It's never going to leave the data center. Turn it off. So group policy is a great tool for implementing some of this stuff. Some of this stuff, absolutely, you could put into your image. But my philosophy is let's do as little with the image as possible, and let's use the tools that we have in the environment to manage it more dynamically. Because once it's in the image, it's very static, right? It doesn't change until I build a new image. With group policy, I can turn things off or turn things on more dynamically, so that's kind of cool. So I can turn off unneeded services. I can disable some of those components I talked about. Let's do a quick demo so that you can see this, since I've been yakking away for the last 15 minutes. Before I get on with this, any questions on any of the things that I've talked about? Question?
Yeah, you talked about placing VDIs in a separate OEU, and things where that's not plausible.
Right, so the question is, if you can't put your VDI systems in a separate OEU, is there a WMI filter that you could use instead? So the answer is, there's nothing necessarily that's going to identify a VDI instance as VDI unless you put something there. So there may be, so let me step back and say, you know, for example, in a Hyper-V environment, when you have a virtual machine, there's some virtual, integration services stuff that gets installed in that virtual machine to optimize video and things like that. And that's software that's installed on the machine. So it's possible you might be able to use a WMI filter to detect those integration services and filter based on that. It's probably not straightforward. You might consider putting them in a security group, like a machine group, and doing a filter based on the machine group. That might be a better, more reliable way to go. That does require you to kind of maintain that security group as you add new VDI instances. But that's probably the better way. There may be something you can find a key off of. Yes, absolutely. Great question. How about a USB charger? Cool. Yeah, thank you. All right, let's do a little demo action here. Yeah, quick question in the back. If you can step up to the mic, it might be easier from the back. Oh, it's not on?
What would you say to an information security group who still wants you to BitLock or encrypt, you know, the hard drives of virtual machines, because they say that, you know, what about if a user gets a hold of the VHD file, take it off premise and attach it to a hypervisor and bring it up that way, with that, and they'd have access to the data there.
Right. So did everyone hear the question? So if your information security folks are saying, we still want you to BitLocker or encrypt your virtual machine, well, there's a couple answers that I could give. One is probably not politically correct.
I'm fine with that.
I have a love-hate relationship with InfoSec people.
I have a hate-hate relationship.
Yeah, hate-hate. Hate-hate's probably better. No, okay, here's the reality. These things are sitting in a data center, most likely, right? Do you have physical security in your data center, in your raised floor?
Absolutely.
Do you have, can any schmuck off the street walk into your raised floor data center and grab a disk or, stick a USB device into the server and grab a VHD out? If so, BitLocker, go for it. that's honestly, unless I'm missing some big security requirement, I think it's just a waste. And you incur some performance penalties by using it in that shared environment. Yes? I will talk all about that. Question?
What about antivirus scanning?
Antivirus scanning, right. So if the antivirus, typically most antivirus solutions have a centralized console that you can use to manage all the devices. If they don't, maybe they have an ADM or an ADMX file that lets you manage them through group policy. What I would recommend is, if you have to do antivirus scanning of the whole system, then you stagger the scanning. So don't have all your machines wake up at 3 a.m. to do their scanning. Put them in some kind of staggered interval, or maybe you don't scan them all, maybe you don't scan every one of them all the time, but definitely try to stagger them. If you can turn it off, most folks won't do that, but you can turn it off, great, but if you have to do it, stagger it.
Yep. I have a related question.
Wow. Yeah.
What about real-time scanning or on-access scanning? Is that the same rule, or is that okay?
Real-time and on-access scanning, you're trading off your business and security requirements with performance. It's going to add disk I/O because you're doing extra cycles to have to service an I/O request. So it really gets down to sizing the environment versus your security requirements. It's there for a reason, and if you've got users that have unfettered access to the internet, then I would be loath to turn it off.
Okay.
Yeah, good questions. All right, let me just jump into this now. Let's see. So what I've done here is, you can see this. I've gone ahead and created my, put this someplace where you can see it. I've gone ahead and created my VDIOU, and I have a number of GPOs that I'm going to talk about here. Let's start with this one. So I've created some services. I've used the system services section to disable services that I've talked about. I did some administrative template stuff to disable offline files and system restore. Let me just go in and bring this up so you can kind of see what I'm doing. If I go in under computer, these are per computer settings that I'm doing here. Security settings, system services. You'll see here that I've got a number of services that have been detected, and I can go in. This is Defender. I can go in and tell it to be disabled. So I can just go in through group policy and manage the startup of services. And as long as your users are not administrator on their workstation, which should be a no-no for everyone, then they can't change this. Now, the other thing I can do, which is kind of a cool new feature, is if you're in a group policy preferences world, you can actually do the same kind of service management through group policy preferences. And one of the advantages of doing it here is you get a few more options. So not only can you change the startup type, but you can actually have it restart the service, stop the service when the policy is processed. The other system services setting, it will set the startup type to disabled, but that won't take effect if the service is already running until the machine is rebooted. So the little added perk that you get with GP preferences, if you do it that way instead, is you're able to actually stop the service and also disable it. Okay, so let me just show you what I did with admin templates here. If I go in under Windows Components, you'll see here that I go back up to network, offline files, and I simply disabled offline files by saying allow or disallow use of the offline files feature. So doing this means that none of the user's data will be cached on the machine's hard drive. Again, if you're in a non-persistent disk or non-persistent VM world, the goal is to keep the image as clean as possible because that image is going to go away the next time the user hits the environment. So there's no value or benefit in writing stuff to the operating system image to the directories that are held by the operating system. Great if it's user data, great if it's applications, but no benefit whatsoever in putting, you know, using operating system features that write to the disk because it's going to get eliminated the next time around. Question?
Play into using non-persistent desktop.
Right. So how does group policy preferences play into using non-persistent desktop? The goal here is, so it depends on how you're implementing the non-persistent desktop. But what you want is that group policy will apply equally to either a persistent or non-persistent desktop. Now, certain group policy settings like logon scripts or software installation only apply during, let's say, a user logon. So if I'm on a non-persistent desktop and I have something that's doing something in the logon script, it's going to get executed at logon time, it's going to make changes to my system, and then those changes are going to just go away when that persistent or non-persistent desktop goes away. The same holds true really for group policy preferences, that the exception being that it's writing to different places in the operating system. Maybe it's writing to non-policy related keys in the registry, or it's changing service startup types, or whatever it happens to be. You know, those changes are being written, and then they're being discarded. So you're essentially using group policy to dynamically configure your desktop, regardless of persistent or non-persistent.
That then you could use group policy preferences, the detailed settings that you get under group policy preferences in a non-persistent desktop that would allow you that fundamental control to shut the service down when the user starts it.
That's right. Well, yes, if the user has the ability to restart the service, you're saying, can I use this
Well, nobody here uses administrator accounts for their users, right?
Right. Yes, that's actually also true with the regular system services lockdown. In fact, the difference being that with regular system services lockdown, it takes 16 hours. If nothing has changed in your group policy environment, it takes 16 hours for that system services policy to refresh itself. But with group policy preferences, especially if you're using it in replace mode, if you have a replace action on that system services thing, then every time background refresh runs, it's going to reprocess that disabling command. So it's a little bit different behavior. It's not so much... it is because of preferences. It's specifically preferences has that behavior. Okay. All right, let's go ahead and switch back to the PowerPoint. So let's talk about that video performance. Depending on which environment you're in, you can do certain kinds of tweaks within group policy. So if you're in a remote... In Microsoft VDI environment using RDP and the remote desktop connection broker and the remote desktop session host, then you have a number of policy templates that you get out of the box that you can tweak, and you can target these at your VMs using group policy targeting against that VDI instance or that VDI OU that I talked about. This is the section within group policy, and it gives you a number of different options. I'll go into some of these, but things like max color depth, you can turn down the color depth. All of this stuff has an impact on, you know, the performance that the user gets if they're on high latency links or low bandwidth links. You can configure remote FX, some of the other things that you can do within the experience. And again, I'll do a little quick demo of this. If you're using Outlook, then there's no reason to have cache mode enabled. Right, cache mode is basically download all my mail to the local hard drive, usually to the local settings folder, which doesn't roam, and persists on the desktop, download all my local mail there. Well, do you really need that in a VDI environment? Probably not. It's writing a bunch of data to the disk that if it's non-persistent, it's going to get discarded. And you're in the data center. You should be close to your exchange servers. You shouldn't need to have cache mode enabled. So here's the path for disabling it. I'll show you that in a second as well. There are a number of settings within group policy that themselves contribute to. Yeah, question. Yeah. Yes, the Microsoft, the RDP settings only apply to the Microsoft VDI implementation. Each of the vendors in the market have ADM templates that you can add to group policy to configure their protocol behavior. So whether it's Citrix or VMware, you have options there, right? So this is specific, yes, to Microsoft RDP. So there's some settings in group policy you want to avoid. So there's a setting in security settings that lets you do file system and registry permissions. And if you're setting big trees of file system and registry permissions through group policy and it's reprocessing it every 16 hours, well, imagine how disk intensive it is to re-permission a folder tree and then do that every 16 hours. Do you really need to do that every 16 hours? If you really need to set file system and registry permissions, do it in your image. So it's set once, and it's there, and you don't need to reinforce it over time. If you really feel like you need to reinforce it over time, then you could either refresh your image if you're in a non-persistent desktop environment, or just send a script to the machine to do that on kind of a controlled basis. So don't do that in group policy. Question? Yeah, sorry. Right, so the question is, do I recommend installing Office on the image or streaming Office? I could probably answer yes to both of those. So the challenge there is, do you want to have to maintain Office in the image every time Office gets an update and have to refresh that to all of your, if you're using non-persistent desktops, then you have to refresh all of your users. But the other side of it is, okay, if I'm streaming Office, let's say with AppV, are most of my users roaming users on slow links? And is that first download going to be really painful for them? So it might be an answer that says, for certain user populations, it makes sense to put it in the image. For others, it makes sense to stream it. I have a tendency to want to keep as much as possible out of the image. But I know people that say, if it's an app that everyone uses, let's just put it in the image. So, not much of an answer there. Performance-wise, from a VDI perspective, I would tend to go towards the streaming model because the goal with streaming is you just have a base image and all of your apps are delivered dynamically, and that's my sort of nirvana. If I think about it in a nirvana world without all the real-world implications of that, like I mentioned about low bandwidth types of situations, then that's the best, I think.
Just okay. A comment on that?
Sorry?
That's the way we're doing it right now with our VDIs. We're streaming down Office, and we see no performance at it whatsoever with that. So that's the way we chose to do it, and we're very happy with it.
Great. Thank you. Okay. So other settings that could impact performance. Well, here's one that you may not think about, but screensaver. How many of your users have picked one of those fancy 3D freaking out across the screen types of screensavers? And that's a lot of video that you're having to push over a pipe for no good reason. So forcing that behavior through group policy is something we can do very easily. And then visual effects that can impact the client. There's a little UI under the computer's properties that lets you adjust for best performance or best appearance. In a VDI environment, I typically recommend to go for adjust for best performance. It takes out some of the nifty little Windows 7 UI widgets that it can do, but it reduces the amount of bandwidth that the user has to visually deal with. And unfortunately, this is a per-user setting that cannot be configured through group policy. So this is something you have to do in your default profile that each user gets when they get VDI installed. Okay. Can you do it with preferences in the registry? It's a painful set of registry tweaks that you would probably tear your hair out trying to discover. Yes. Okay, and then this is a simple one, but just wanted to point out that, you know, if you're in a Microsoft RDP environment, those users have to be able to RDP to their virtual machines. And so you can use group policy restricted groups or group policy preferences users and groups to add your users to the remote desktop users group on all their VDI machines. So that's pretty straightforward. Let's take a quick look at some of these policies now. So I created this performance and experience policy, and I created some restricted groups policy. I set up some remote session host stuff, and then I did some personalization on the user side. So cache mode and screensaver. Let's go ahead and pop this guy open so we can take a look at some of these. So let's just start with restricted groups. Restricted groups, as many of you know, has two modes. One mode is I want to absolutely control the membership of this local group, so strip out any groups that get put in there except the ones I say. And the other mode is I want to add group A to group B on all machines. And it's the second mode that I'm using here. So if I go into restricted groups, you'll see here I've got a group that I created called VDI users, and I created an entry for that, and then I said this group is a member of the remote desktop users group. So the VDI members of the VDI users group, who are all my users that get VDI, get added to remote desktop users on all my VDI systems.
Oops.
I can also do this again through preferences. There's a preferences feature for users and groups, and it's very similar. I can say local group. I can tell it the group name, and it has a list of all the built-in groups. You know, I can say remote desktop users, and I can add users to it. So I can do it the same way. There's a few more features on this. You can delete all members, delete all users. You can actually, if you set this on a per user basis, you can actually tell it to add the currently logged on user to a group. Not too helpful for remote desktop users. It's kind of a chicken and the egg problem. They have to be in remote desktop users in order to be able to log on. But that is a nice feature of the preferences capabilities within groups. Let me just take a quick look here at my other settings so I can show you what I've done. Okay, remote desktop services, session host. So if I go into admin templates, Windows components, remote desktop services, and let me expand this out so you can actually see what I'm doing, and I go to the remote session environment. You'll see here that I've got a number of settings options that I've enabled. So I can do things like color depth. I can enforce removal of the desktop wallpaper. Again, if they have a picture of their kid on their desktop wallpaper, do you really need to see that across RDP? Right? Do you need to render that every time the desktop gets refreshed? Probably not. So another, do not allow font smoothing, clear type. You can turn off clear type. That all this stuff adds to the graphical bandwidth that's being used to display to that remote client. And it, you know, one thing to keep in mind about these is you may decide you want some users to have these and some to not have them. You can differentiate using group policy targeting, and we'll talk a little bit about that when I start to talk about loopback. But essentially, you don't have to have this apply to every VDI user in your environment. And then let's look at the personalization that I did. All I did here was I forced a specific screensaver. In this case, screensave.scr is the blank screensaver that ships by default in Windows. And then if I go in, what I did here is I actually loaded up the Office 2010 ADM templates or ADMX templates, and I am using those in my group policy object to turn off cache mode for these VDI users. All right. Oops, and I killed my GPMC, so let me bring that back up before I go on. All righty. So let's move on. So loopback. Why loopback? Can anyone tell me what loopback does? You raised your hand first. Excellent. USB power thingy for you. So the answer was it lets you apply specific, it lets you apply a specific set of user policies to a specific set of machines when the user logs on to those machines. So you can imagine that in a VDI environment, this is kind of the perfect tool because VDI machines are different than your physical machines, so you want user policy to apply differently when they're logged on to VDI machines versus physical machines. So implementing loopback, and especially if you have users that switch between physical machines, physical desktops, and virtual desktops, using loopback is kind of a key enabling technology, just like it is in ZenApp or terminal server application environments, right? So you're essentially saying that when I log onto this VDI machine, I want the user to have a different user experience than when they log onto their regular physical machine. All of that stuff that I've turned off on a per user basis can be delivered regardless of where the user object is in AD. So to put a finer point on it, I've got my VDI OU, if my user account exists somewhere else in, let's say, the marketing OU, and I'm delivering some per user settings to my user who's in the marketing OU because they're there, and then that user logs onto a machine in the VDI OU, I want them to have not their marketing OU settings, but their VDI OU settings. And that's what loopback does for us. I think I see a question way in the back. Yes? I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Is there any performance difference between using loopback versus applying directly to the user objects?
Is there any performance difference between applying loopback? Not really. Not anything significant. What loopback will do is when the user logs on to a machine that has loopback enabled, is it will see that flag, and instead of going and enumerating the list of GPOs that the user would normally get, it enumerates a different list, those that apply to the machine. So it's really not a, if you're using, the only, let me put a caveat on that. There's two modes for loopback. One is merge, one is replace. In merge, it says run the user's per user settings, their normal per user settings first, and then apply the loopback per user settings again, or second. There could be a performance degradation because you're doing essentially two sets of settings. In replace mode, it's only doing the machine-based user settings.
Just another quick one. On the previous example, you had adding the Office templates. If you're doing just one setting, is it better to strip out that one registry change versus adding in the entire template?
Right. So is it better to just, if you're just doing one setting, do I really need all of those templates? And the answer is no, you don't. If you're versed in ADM or ADMX syntax, it's easy enough to go into those ADMX files or just XML, find the registry path, find the registry value, and then you could do it through group policy preferences registry.
Now, is that an actual performance hit if you include all the templates?
It's not a performance hit. Okay. The templates are only there for your editing pleasure. When the setting is in the GPO, they don't come into play for processing. Question right in the front. Right, so the question is if they have a terminal server profile versus a desktop profile. In the VDI scenario, we're not using terminal server profiles. We just have a single profile, just like they would on a physical desktop. If you had a terminal services environment, then it would be a different story, and it's a completely different profile. The policies will still apply to the terminal server profile, but because you're on the terminal server, it's applying a different profile. So in VDI, we're just one profile, we'll rule them all. Okay. So I already talked about merge and replace. I've already kind of talked about when it makes sense. It's really depends on if your users are 100% VDI users. In other words, they only log into VDI systems, no physical desktops. You probably don't need loopback because they only need one set of user settings. But loopback in the scenario where you've got, you know, users that are doing both, maybe they access their VDI instance when they're remote, but when they're in the office, they're on their physical box, then VDI makes a lot of sense. So, easy to do, create a loopback GPO on the computer objects, in this case our VDI OU. Define those per user optimizations that we were looking at earlier. You can either define them in the GPO that enables loopback, or you can have separate GPOs like I have. As long as loopback is enabled, and as long as the per user settings apply to the machine, then life is good. And you link that GPO to your VDI OU, and you're done. So let's kind of dig into that a little bit. So go back to my world here. You got my loopback policy here. It's really straightforward. In this case, I only have the setting in here to enable loopback. It's under admin templates, system, group policy. And again, I'm in the OU where all of my machine accounts live. All my desktop virtual machines live in this OU. If I go down here to user group policy loopback processing mode, I can enable it and choose the mode here. That's all I have to do. Once this applies to my virtual machines, then every time a user logs into them, they're going to get any user settings that apply to the computer instead of the user on that virtual machine. So all of these settings that I did for performance and experience that were per user, if I go into the settings here, anything that's per user, these settings that I created here, are going to get applied only when I log into that VDI instance. Okay, does that make sense? Question?
Does the order of the policies come, the loopback GPO has to be processed first?
Right. So the question is, does the ordering count? Does the loopback have to be processed first? You know, the only reason you would do that is so that loopback gets enabled the very first thing for when the machine starts up. So loopback is a per computer setting. So enabling it, you know, you want to have that happen early on in the process, right? But it only has to process it once. Once it's on, the order doesn't really matter that much. I put it up there because, you know, I just want to make sure that it does get processed early. But keep in mind that it's a per computer setting, so when the machine restarts, it's going to do per computer processing before the user has even had a chance to figure out if the machine is in loopback. So it's going to install the loopback enabling setting before there's any users involved. So chances are, no matter what order it's in, the user's going to get it. Okay. Yeah, question?
Is it possible to
have loopback that has some users that doesn't apply to? Yes. Yes. So the question is it possible to have loopback, but then have it not apply to all users? And the answer is yes. You can do this using security group filtering just like you can in any other setting. So all loopback does is say, instead of paying attention to the GPOs that apply to the user in the OU they normally live in, apply the settings from the GPOs that the computer, the location where the computer lives. Now let's say I have my loopback policy here, and I had all my loopback per user settings in here. I could go into this just like I can with, let me go down to group policy objects, loopback policy. And instead of authenticated users, which means all users get this, I could say, no, I want these per user settings to only apply to VDI users. And these per user settings in loopback mode would only apply to VDI users. Now, keep in mind, that in this particular GPO, I also have per computer settings in here. So I have to make sure I include the computers as well. So I can just say default computers. Or I'm sorry, domain computers. And that way my VDI setting also applies. My loopback setting also applies. Now, so does that answer your question? Yes. So he wants the policy to apply to everyone except the senior executive. Well, there's a couple ways to skim that. Probably the most obvious way for me is to use a deny ACE. So let's say, go ahead and bring up my Active Directory environment, and let's create a group called Whiny Execs. All right, so we have our Whiny Execs group, and they don't want to get these pathetic little VDI settings. So what I can do, I'm in delegation on the GPO. I can go in under advanced. I can go in here, add Whiny Execs. And you'll see here that by default, they get allow ACEs, an allow ACE for read and apply, actually for read. And what I can do is set a deny on the apply group policy permission. And what that essentially does is say, I can read the GPO, but I can't apply it. I can't process it if I'm in this Whiny Execs group. And that lets you kind of create exceptions. Again, this is an exception-based process. I wouldn't recommend doing this across the board, because what you're going to notice is, look at what comes back in the reporting in GPMC, custom. It doesn't even tell you it's a deny ACE. If you sprinkle a lot of these across your GPOs, there's nowhere in GPMC that explicitly tells you it's a deny ACE unless you drill into it. So it becomes, you know, if admin A over here sets it at point in time 1, and then admin B comes along at point in time 10 and doesn't know to look for this thing, it's not exposed very well and it can cause a lot of issues. It does not show up in any reports. It's poorly documented, unfortunately. So the alternative is, instead of using a deny ACE, that the group that you allow, let's say VDI users, does not include the executives, you create a second GPO with the settings that is just permission, the settings that you want, that's just permission to the execs. Or a separate OU. Yep, you build your own VDI infrastructure for them and let them pay for it. Yeah. That's right. Yep. Got questions coming all over. Yep, right over there. Yes, if you do a GP result, it will show that the group policy was denied because of security filtering. Good point. Question in back.
Is there any reason not to deny the read as well?
The only reason you wouldn't want to deny a read is because if you're doing reporting or you're trying to troubleshoot, that GPO for the user that's getting that deny, that has that deny, shows up as inaccessible. If it can't even read the GPO, then you can't see the name of it. You can't, yeah, reporting kind of gets messed up.
Is there any performance?
No performance. Okay. No performance impact. Question here. Good question that segues into my next session. Is it possible without using roaming profiles for users to maintain their session, their settings as they move between desktops? You're my setup man. Actually, it's the next section. So what I'm going to talk about now is a little bit about, you know, VDI imaging. So when you're creating your VDI templates, and every vendor calls it something slightly different, but usually template is a good word. It's the image that you're using to replicate out as your VDI image. Are you creating them as domain joined machines? If so, are they getting policy? Some policies like to tattoo the system's config. like security settings. If you are building your machines in the domain and they're getting a bunch of security settings because they happen to be in a particular OU, and you don't necessarily want those settings in your VDI world, you have to be conscious of what you're doing, because it's really difficult to extract those settings once they're applied. Security settings are particularly thorny because it's not just a matter of setting the setting to not defined in a GPO and it's going to go away on the target computer. That generally does not happen. And in Windows 7, there's no 100% way without re-imaging to get the system back to the default in-the-box vanilla security config. There used to be this thing called the default setup security template in XP, and you could use the SecEdit utility to apply that to your machine, and it would essentially revert it back to default security settings across the board. There's nothing to do that in Windows 7, so it becomes a lot harder. And you may have different requirements for your persistent desktops versus your non-persistent. So this is something you need to pay attention to. If you're creating non-persistent virtual sessions, then you could have those settings, especially critical per machine settings that need to be there as soon as the machine is composed, pre-baked into your template. That may be a good thing. I can think of security settings as being an example of that. But if you're not, then you probably want GP to do its normal thing. If they are persistent desktops, it probably is best to just leave them out and let GP do its thing. So you can create the image in the domain, let policy process as normal, and then prepare your image. Each time the new VM is created, it gets the correct starting settings, and then anything that would get delivered through group policy normally would get laid on top of that. For persistent desktops, again, it probably depends a little bit about your requirements, but I say, you know, don't build the image with all of the GP settings from the domain in there. Let it happen normally when the machine is built, when the machine comes up and the user logs on. And the reason I say that it's different for persistent is because those machines are going to be around for a while, just like physical desktops. So it makes sense to let them get policy the way physical desktops would. Question? Yes, good question. Is it wise to put your golden image into its own OU? And you just perfectly set up my next slide. So if you want a GP-free image, create a staging OU, whatever you want to call it, with block inheritance set. Block inheritance is that flag on the OU that says don't process any upstream GPOs. And assuming any of those upstream GPOs don't have an enforced flag set on them, then that machine won't get any policy. And you can build your image, do whatever you need to do, and then when the time comes, you can essentially move it to the staging OU, do a GP update force to make sure that any policies that don't tattoo are removed, and then tattooed policies will remain, but they can be overwritten through the normal GP processing cycle. Now, one caveat I want to make on this is if you have a staging domain, a different domain from where the VDI systems are going to be built, it's very problematic when you have GPOs that are delivered in one domain and then you move that machine or build a virtual machine based on that image and you have GPO settings baked into that foreign domain image. You bring them into a new domain. They have no connection whatsoever to the new domain. The normal GP setting removal process, even for admin template settings, which are not supposed to tattoo, break. So you will have tattooed settings in that new virtual machine image in the second domain. So if you're moving between domains, it's absolutely critical that you make sure that that domain, you know, the domain A image is empty of GP. And again, this is 99% of this is per computer settings that we care about. We don't care about per-user settings because the per-user settings come from the user's or get pushed into the user's profile when the user logs on. That doesn't exist when you're creating the image. All right. User state virtualization. This is what Microsoft calls this idea of roaming profiles and folder redirection. So essentially, this is the technology that you use in the Microsoft world to separate user state from the OS. User profiles have been around for a long time. Most of us have been very afraid of them or have had bad experiences with them. They have gotten a lot better in Windows 7. They've solved some really thorny issues that have had happened in the past that made them problematic. That being said, there are other alternatives on the third-party software market, like companies like AppSense and Res, that do user state virtualization that is completely separate and independent of user profiles and folder redirection. And they may be good solutions for you in the VDI infrastructure. What I'm going to talk about is, if you're not going and spending money on this, that there is technology in the box that you can use and manage through group policy. So again, the goal is to decouple as much of the user settings as possible from the desktop VM. And if you're in non-persistent mode, this is really critical, because if the user makes a bunch of user settings changes and then logs off, that machine's gone forever. And those settings are not going to persist if you're not using something that does user state virtualization. So roaming profile is really simple to enable. You set a profile path in the user's AD object. Quick screenshot here. This is all there is to it. You have a share out on a file server somewhere, and you set the path for the user, and it creates the directory, and then the next time the user logs onto that machine and then logs off, during that log off cycle, the profile is written up to the share. It's basically the same operation for years. It's been that way. Roaming profile behavior can be controlled through group policy, admin templates. You can change the slow network behavior. In other words, how should I upload or download profiles if I encounter a slow network connection to my profile share server? Background update of ntuser.dat. This is a new feature in Windows 7. Windows will periodically upload changes from in ntuser.dat, which is essentially is HK current user. So if the user changes their background or they change a setting in Outlook, that gets stored in ntuser.dat. That can periodically write those changes up without waiting for the user to log off. That way, if something happens to the user setting, all those changes, or to user session, all those changes are not lost if they're not able to log off normally. Profile unload retries. There was a big problem in earlier versions of Windows where when you logged off, the profile didn't completely unload correctly, and you couldn't manage it. If you were in an environment where you were deleting it on log off, it wouldn't delete. You get all these profiles on a system, it was a real pain, especially in terminal server environments. Well, they fixed that and given you some tweaks to essentially improve that behavior. And you can also exclude directories from roaming. Maybe you have a directory in the profile, you don't want it copied up to the server because you don't really want to keep that data. You can exclude those within this policy area that I've specified here. Question? Right, so the question is there a recommended number of profiles to put on a server? And, you know, frankly, there's no easy answer to that. It's going to depend on network topology, the server capability, you know, what's the backing storage on the server, how quick is the access to that storage. If it's a SAN or a NAS device, it may have a lot more capability than a standard file server. You know, I've seen everywhere from 100 to thousands. And it really just depends on your network and the server that it's hitting. Unfortunately, it's not a great answer, but it's the answer. Okay, folder redirection is the kind of complementary technology to user profiles. It lets you, okay, you have a roaming profile that's copying all that data up to a profile share on log on and log off. It's copying it down on log on and up on log off. Maybe I don't want to go through that process, that time it takes to do that every time. Why don't I redirect the user data parts of the profile, in other words, documents, pictures, videos, to a completely separate share using a completely separate process and let that data be handled separately. And that's what folder redirection is all about, getting as much of the user's profile shunted off to a different server or a different process from the roaming profile as possible. Now, you know, you can use this in conjunction with roaming profiles. In Windows 7, you have a lot more options in terms of the folders you can redirect, and I'll show you a little bit about that. And you want to do this if you're in this mode where you know the user's part-time on a physical desktop and part-time on a virtual desktop. You're going to want to do this you're going to want to make sure that the redirection happens on the user object regardless of where they're at. You want it to happen on both. Otherwise, you can get into scenarios where if it's redirected on virtual and not redirected on physical, you're going to get data loss and all kinds of complications for the user. So it's controlled through group policy, much more robust, lots of folders that you can do. You get a picture of it here, and you can essentially redirect to the same location for everyone, or you can redirect based on group membership. So you can have a different server for the marketing users versus the sales users versus the engineering users. So when the user gets this policy, it's a per-user policy, and they first log on, what happens is, before they get their desktop, all of the data in the folders that you've redirected is copied up to the server share that you've specified. And so it's up there, the user's, it's essentially moved there, and offline files is enabled so that the data is cached. So if you've disabled offline files, it's just up on the server. It's not cached locally. And then you can also specify the behavior. What happens if the policy no longer applies? Do I leave the files up on the server? Do I bring them back to my local profile? You can set this folder redirection on the user's AD object that's not part of loopback if you've enabled loopback. This is what I was saying just a few minutes ago. You want the policy for folder redirection to apply to the user object regardless of whether they are on a VDI system or a physical system so that you don't get ping-ponging of their data back and forth. There's no per computer setting required for folder redirection. So let me just show you this quickly because we're running out of time. I want to make sure I get to this. I created a user state virtualization policy. Let me just go ahead and show you this. So I've got my user state policy, per user settings, Windows settings, folder redirection. You'll see all the folders that I have an opportunity to redirect. If I go into something like My Documents, you'll see I chose basic folder redirection. Creates a folder under the user's root path that I specified here. It gives you the example. In this case, I specified my server name and my share, and it will automatically create the folder under my username called Documents. I can also specify how I want this thing to behave, if I want it to apply to down-level systems, if I have down-level systems, because it's different behavior on Windows 7 or Vista versus XP. And then I can tell it what to do on policy removal. And the advanced redirection lets you specify based on group. So I can say for a particular group, I can put it in a particular server. And using this in combination with user roaming profiles, you get kind of the best of both worlds. So if I go up to my server, you can see here under the profile share, I've got my profile. And essentially, I don't have access to it, but if I was looking at this, I would see the ntuser.dat and some other folders that I hadn't redirected. And then if I went into user data, I would see a bunch of folders that I had redirected. So the goal there is to get as much data out of the roaming profile process as possible. Question?
Yeah, where you had groups in your demo.
Yes.
If you have a user that's a member of multiple groups, say they were, let's say they're physical location based, right? And you have your user at a site and the server is close to the site, and physically that server, the user moves to another site permanently but doesn't get taken out of the one site for whatever reason, your identity management system isn't working right. And now the user's in the site group at the other site, so if they're in this group, they go to this server and share.
Right.
If they're in this group, they go to this server and share. If they're in both groups, what happens?
If they're in both groups, that's a good question. There's probably an order of precedence where the last group that it reads, the last group membership that it reads wins. But I don't think you want to get into that if you can at all avoid it, because what it's going to essentially, Yeah, honestly, I don't know where that's going to land. My guess is his last writer wins. It's a bad situation. So I've talked a lot about why VDI is different, why you should think about it differently from a group policy perspective, how you should think about user experience, VDI imaging considerations, user state virtualization. Hopefully this was useful. I think there's there are other sessions that I tried to list here that are still remaining sessions for you guys if you're interested in more stuff. There's some virtualization certification stuff, a demo station on MDOP that has some of the related technology like AppV, and absolutely fill out the evaluation. I would definitely appreciate feedback because this is the first time I've done this session, and I really, if there's any other questions, feel free to